This is The Nightlife, and you're with Rod Quinn. You know, a lot of people think that young people have it easy these days, but try telling that to someone who's trying to buy their first home. Maybe you're watching your children or grandchildren trying to buy a house and seeing them priced out of the market time and time again. Pick up any newspaper recently, particularly in the big cities, and the headlines tell a story about first home buyers being pushed out of the housing market by cashed up investors. And the latest figures from the ABS tell the same story. The proportion of first home buyers buying properties has hit an all-time low since the ABS started keeping records, made up only 12.5% of the market in September, compared with about 30% only a few years ago. So that's dropped by more than half. And yet we are hearing that on the whole, housing affordability is actually improving. That is hard to believe, particularly with interest rates being so low. So how big a problem is housing affordability really? Tonight we're exploring housing affordability. Our guests are Associate Professor Nicole Gurran from the Faculty of Architecture, Design and Planning at the University of Sydney, and Jackie Phillips from Australians for Affordable Housing. Nicole and Jackie, a very good evening to you.
Thank you.
Nicole, let me start with you. Why are houses so unaffordable, or are they?
Well, for anyone trying to buy their first home, of course, particularly low and moderate income earners, you know, teachers, police, people on a median income and even a bit above, house prices have become incredibly inaccessible, particularly in our major cities. But people who are already in the market, of course, have grown a reasonable amount of equity. So housing affordability is less a problem for established homeowners.
Jackie, do you think it might be better, in fact, for some, for interest rates to be higher, because that might price those who might be paying two mortgages out of the market? In fact, that the low interest rates are working against first-time buyers.
Well, I think the role of investors in the market is a complex one, and obviously we can see that first-home buyers are being priced out, but we also need some investors in the market, you know, to make sure that we have enough available rental properties. The issue is affordability, so directing that investment towards new houses to build the total housing stock that we have and towards houses that are affordable.
Okay, so this seems like a simple question. How do we make houses more affordable? Nicole, do you want to jump in on that?
Well, I think we've got to make a commitment that we want to increase the number of homes that are produced that are actually affordable to low and moderate income earners. For quite some time, the focus has been just on trying to boost overall numbers of new homes, and we know that that doesn't actually address affordability for lower and moderate income households.
Is it the case that people need to, I hate to say this, learn to live outside the big cities as well, to move to regional areas or to other places where houses are more affordable? There are some places in Australia where you might think, oh, what are you talking about, house affordability? They're very affordable houses. Is it just that people in the cities tend to complain?
We generally don't think highly of people who move to more affordable housing markets because they tend to be places of lower employment opportunities. And so you get a very ugly term. It's called welfare migration. It's an awful description of what happens when people are actually pushed out of high-value housing markets because, of course, our housing markets are more expensive in the capital cities because that's where the opportunities for employment, education, services, etc. are. So we can only expect people to move to regional centres when we're prepared to invest in regional centres and when we're prepared to see education opportunities, employment opportunities and lifestyle opportunities move with the migrants.
And does that include the outer suburbs of the major cities?
Affordability in the outer suburbs. Basically, there's a leash. A decade ago, you could be within, say, 15 kilometres of Melbourne CBD. So analysis by Judy Yates, one of our leading housing economists, shows that in the past decade, in Melbourne, for instance, you've needed to move an extra 15 kilometres out of Melbourne CBD just to afford an affordable house. So there becomes a point at which we have to say, how far are we expecting people to move beyond the employment centres and beyond access to public transport?
Is Australia unique in this regard? I mean, are we the least affordable country in the world for buying houses, or are there other countries in the world that in fact are far worse than Australia?
We have some of the highest affordability pressures in the world at the moment. That's not to say that on the whole our housing system is actually stronger than many other nations, because we've got such a high proportion of Australians still in home ownership. So we've still got around about 68% of Australians in home ownership, although that has been dropping. So housing affordability in Australia has become a problem in the last decade, and I think it's a problem that's kind of crept up on us.
What role do the banks and the lenders have in this regard as well? That in Australia, it is in some ways difficult to get a home loan, unlike in, you know, we've seen what happened in the United States and subprime and that whole situation. Is it in fact too difficult to get a loan in Australia?
Our lending criteria has actually protected our housing market in Australia, and so that's generally regarded to be a positive. What has been problematic is the price inflation that's grown, particularly between 1996 to 2004. And what happened there was an exponential growth in prices, and it really lifted house prices out of the purchasing power of middle-income earners. And that's where we really saw the significant change, right, I suppose, in our housing system.
A lot of people say, oh, it's foreign investors coming in to buy the houses. That's what's causing the trouble. Are there any statistics at all for how many houses are being bought by foreign investors that we would be able to look at and say, yeah, okay, obviously there might be a problem there?
Well, I'm a researcher, and I think that's a number one research topic. I mean, we don't know enough about the implications of foreign investment in Australia's housing market. It is a new thing. I understand that the data is relatively difficult to get, but certainly I think we should be looking very carefully at the investment profile of and how that's shaping where houses are being produced and the types of homes that are being produced.
So when people say, oh, there are too many coming in, you can look and say, well, actually, we don't know how many are coming in.
Foreign investors.
Yes.
There have been recent changes to make foreign investment of new properties relatively easier. And I don't have the figures at hand. I'm not sure how accessible they are.
Yeah,
and
so,
we'd need a certain period of time anyway to monitor that and to see what impact that's had on the market and indeed on new housing production as well.
In the, say, 70s and 80s, even into the 90s, there was a boom in some suburbs, outer suburbs, for really big houses. Are they now white elephants because people don't want to live there anymore? Or they don't need a house that size? Families are smaller? Is that a problem? Is that going to solve the problem in a way?
Oh, that's a really interesting question, Rod. In fact, in the United States, that's the next housing fear, is that the suburbs, the baby boomers' suburbs, yeah, will become white elephants and that they'll be depopulated, because there's certainly now an increasing preference for walkability, for being near public transport, for, you know, that cafe society, and certainly amongst empty nesters. The consensus seems to be that that's not as big an issue yet in Australian suburbs, and we certainly don't have any excess supply of houses. But I do think it's something to keep an eye on, because certainly household sizes are shrinking and preferences are certainly shifting towards accessibility over large houses. And so we do need to keep an eye on those established suburbs and make sure they maintain their value and can change over time.
Okay, you're with Rod Quinn on The Nightlife. Associate Professor Nicole Garran is our guest, and also Jackie Phillips from Australians for Affordable Housing. Jackie, if middle-income earners are struggling to get into the market, what's the situation like for those on low incomes?
It's very tough. I mean, particularly for people who are right at the bottom, that is relying on Social Security payments. But even for those who are on low and middle wage earners, you know, the kinds of people that Nicole was talking about, it's a real struggle. So if you're in the private rental market, for example, and you're a low-income earner, let's say you're in the bottom 40% of income earners, you know, you've got more than 60% of those people are in what we call housing stress. So they're paying too much for their housing. That means they're having to go without other things, that they're making other trade-offs in their lives.
Were they able to buy houses, though, in the past? If we look back 50 years ago, were those in that lower 40%, you might say, able to afford houses?
Certainly housing was much more affordable. I mean, when you look at the ratio of, for example, wages to house prices, that has changed enormously. It used to be something like 1-4, and nowadays we're talking about a ratio, I think, of more than 1-7. So that you need to have, you know, a house price is about 7 times average ages as opposed to only 4 times. So in the big picture over the last few decades, certainly housing has become increasingly unaffordable. And for those at the bottom, virtually impossible, really. When I think the situation used to be quite different, you could be employed, but at a fairly low level, and nonetheless be able to enter the housing market. Nowadays, that's very difficult.
Do you think that people would have to change their dream in a way that, in fact, rather than buying with your husband or wife or partner or whatever, that you might have to buy with other people? There might be, you know, three or four or five people going to buying a house in order to sort of make some money out of it, perhaps, and sell it and then buy something later on. Is this something we're going to have to look at?
I think there's a few issues there. I think that there are a lot of different dreams now. So not everybody has the great Australian dream as their dream, and there's a lot of different lifestyles and different ways of social organising out there, and share houses and others. So that's a certain part of the community. But the way that the Australian housing market is structured is that today there's still the case to say in Australia that the only way to get real security of tenure and stability over the long term, so that you can maintain your links with schools and communities and so on, social supports, is in home ownership. Now, that's quite different to other countries where rental markets are structured so that you can, in fact, live for a long time in one dwelling, get a long-term lease. Mm. There's a lot more stability and security in those systems. We don't have that system here. Our system's geared around the home ownership dream. And so those settings haven't changed.
But in those other countries, you are paying a mortgage. You're just paying someone else's mortgage off. You're not paying your own mortgage off. In Australia, rents are unbelievably high as well, aren't they? You're saying that we need to readjust our aspirations and maybe for some people live in a life where they perpetually rent.
I'm not saying that we should have to do that. I'm saying that I guess that there are different groups that we're talking about. There are some people who are choosing something other than the traditional Australian dream, and that's one scenario. But there are many other people for whom the only way to get stability would be through home ownership, and that's out of reach. And I suppose our view is that there are changes that could be made to policy that would facilitate the entry of those lower middle income earners into home ownership, and that is something that we should be talking about.
People often blame negative gearing for the problem, and yet the statistics show that, you know, a few years ago 30% of the market were first home buyers. Now it's 12.5 or so, the lowest ever. Is it only because of negative gearing, which has basically gone on for as long as I can remember?
Well, with some changes over time, I think the issue with negative gearing from our perspective is that it's neither fair nor efficient. So what it does is provide a subsidy to fairly high income earners to engage in speculative investment in the housing market. In doing so, it locks first homeowners and other lower income, you know, people who are seeking to enter the housing market out of the market, drives up house price inflation. But it also is mainly skewed to investment in existing housing. So what we have is a housing supply crisis at the lower end. We have a drastic shortage of affordable housing properties, about more than 500,000 short at the moment in terms of affordable rental. What negative gearing does is stimulates investment in existing housing. It's not helping us to create any new and affordable housing stock. So we think it's time to have a conversation about negative gearing and the impact that it's having on prices, on first home owners and also on renters.
Okay, so what politicians do you think are going to put their hand up and say, yep, we're going to abolish negative gearing, or really take a look at it?
Look, there's no denying it's a difficult political question, and that's why change hasn't come sooner. But I think we can see, certainly in the media in recent months, growing momentum around this issue, the growing commentary about the problem that it in fact has caused. The housing minister himself said at a conference about a month or two ago that we are facing a looming housing supply crisis. And I don't think we can not talk about the role of housing tax in that context. So we also have a commission of audit happening and a national conversation about what should government be funding and where does government not have a role, what can we afford to do and where should we not be. We're spending about $3 billion a year on negative gearing subsidies. That's a lot of money that could be much better targeted towards, you know, investing in affordable housing. So I guess we're saying it's becoming time for the conversation. There's a tax green paper, white paper coming up over the next few years. Let's use that process to make sure that all options are on the table.
Okay, just on rental markets as well, are there enough affordable rental properties?
No, so that figure that I was referring to, that 500,000 shortage, is the shortage of affordable and available rental properties. So we've got a huge gap there in the demand and the supply.
We'll take some calls in just a moment. Jackie Phillips and Nicole Gurran are our guests on The Nightlife tonight, and you're with Rod Quinn. Do we know anything about anywhere else in the world that perhaps doesn't have negative gearing or that does have programs to create more affordable properties?
Well, I certainly know that Australia is one of the most generous countries in terms of the subsidies that we provide to investors. And our model is a very unusual one, I think, in the international context. So certainly in that sense, we're largely on our own, I think.
There's nothing comparable in New Zealand or Canada? Or
I don't know about New Zealand. I certainly know in the US that you can't claim the losses in the way that you can on other income, so it's quarantined onto the capital gain. So there are changes to the model that we could look at that would certainly improve the affordability picture, whether it was linked to new affordable housing stock or some other measures to review and reshape and retarget that subsidy more effectively.
Okay, we'd love to hear from you as well. The phone number 1300 800 222. Firstly, do you have any solution to the problem? Because we'd love to hear that. 1300 800 222. Maybe you'd like to tell us of your own experience and perhaps the experience of your children if they're going through that now, or maybe you are a potential first home buyer and you'd like to get some advice perhaps on what might be done. 1300 800 222. Perhaps you'd like to text as well. 0467 922 702. 0467 922 702. We don't guarantee we're going to solve your problem, but we are going to hear about it. James in North Melbourne says, we live in a house with no lounge room because it's now a bedroom. Our landlord is essentially a thief. No repairs and two rent rises a year. That's pretty tough, James. Sorry about that. KD says, when I was preparing to get married 30 years ago, my wife and I needed to save $10,000 for a deposit on a $50,000 loan. We could buy a house on a quarter acre. Today, my son would have to save $100,000 and earns $70,000 a year. Impossible to stay around the family. It's splitting families up. And there's no reason, though, that smaller apartments are more common. The text has broken up a little bit. But you get the point of what KD is saying. Why did it happen in the old days? Why were things easier? Nicole?
There was a big change that happened in the mid-1990s. We had financial deregulation, and so there was a sudden tumbling of interest rates and an availability of cheaper loan products. At the same time, we had a very big change in the workforce and in household formations. We had the rise of double income household earners, which were two significant changes in terms of the capacity that people could pay for houses. And what we didn't see was ongoing investment in outer areas and in regional centres. So the places that people want to live in Australia are the established suburbs. Right. Therefore, there's an inherent supply constraint there. So we have price inflation plus constrained supply.
And what we're seeing also in some areas is that instead of building infrastructure to where people are living, they are building huge blocks of flats where infrastructure already exists, which is destroying the way that those old suburbs look. Meg says, your guest is wrong on negative gearing. Paul Keating cut it out in 1988 and it caused an absolute disaster. I was trying to rent and investors had bailed out. It didn't help me. So there were changes at some point.
Yeah, so Paul Keating attempted to make some changes. I think there were a few other things going on in the market at that time, including the attractiveness of the share market and other factors. So I think that sort of scared the horses unnecessarily, potentially. Yeah. And there are certainly ways to review and retarget that measure in a way that wouldn't cause an exodus from the rental housing market, which is the concern that caller's expressing.
Okay, let's start with Luke then, who has a question that Deb wanted to, or had texted about as well. G'day, Luke.
Oh, hi there, Tony. And
it's Rod, and we've got Jackie and Nicole with us this evening. Luke, what's on your mind?
Yeah, g'day. Look, I'm a first-home buyer. My broad question is, finding it very difficult to get into the market, into the Sydney market, my broad question is buying investment properties as a way, and renting as a way to move in into the market or try and own a home. And something I was thinking of personally trying to do was buy a place at the lower end, so something that may need renovation, renovate it with a view to invest it, but then sort of move in.
Yes, okay.
And claim the renovations as a tax deduction and sort of try and improve to try and own a home that's comfortable and quite decent.
Yeah. Okay, look, I will point out that our guests tonight are not investment experts, but they can certainly comment on this, about maybe buying an investment property as a way to get into the market and then eventually living in it.
My view is that, you know, we totally hear where you're coming from. It's a really difficult situation. But what an indictment on our housing system that a first home buyer is saying that they need to play the system by buying a house and renting it out to someone else because they can't actually do what they want to do and what generations of Australians have been able to do in the past, which is buy a house to live in.
Chris, good evening.
Good evening, Rod, Jackie and Nicole. I wanted to say, first of all, what a great conversation to be having at a particularly appropriate time for affordability for the majority of middle-class Australia. My first question is, what effect is, I think, super is having for people buying investment properties and driving the prices up, which I think was mentioned earlier.
So you're saying people, when they access their super, then go and buy investment products?
Well, no, they're buying them and putting them into self-managed funds.
Oh, okay, right, yeah.
And then they have to get a return on investment that is set at a certain percentage. So it's driving the rental market up, the price of rental properties up, which was mentioned earlier by, I think, perhaps Jackie. But second of all, foreign investment, I've seen it firsthand in my suburb, Oakley, where we're having significant Asian foreign investment into the market, paying exorbitant prices for rental units, and then exiting the market 3 or 4 years later, once their children have left the university or the tertiary education system that they've attended. But they know that they're going to get a significant return on their investment because our property market has been probably the most stable of the world market in general. But also, you mentioned about modelling. I think it was Jackie, I'm not too sure. But you mentioned about changing the modelling for funding for more affordable housing. One example that comes directly to mind, I think it's the United States, where, and I think you broached on it earlier, where you're able to get significant tax advantages as a homeowner, offset against interest payments and that sort of thing, where it's set off against your taxable income before you even start paying tax, which means everybody has the right to shelter themselves, and I see it all the time.
Okay, Chris. All right, no worries, mate. We'll get Jackie and Nicole to comment on that. Jackie.
Yeah. Well, I think Chris has raised a number of certainly housing tax issues, which we're keen to, as I said, have a national conversation around. In terms of the self managed super funds, I certainly think that's one area that is ripe for review. And those funds being able to borrow to invest and then dispose of assets without paying capital gains tax, I think is an area that we would certainly be interested in looking at more closely.
Yeah, I'd just maybe say one thing about the rents and the implications of super funds moving into that market. Obviously, it's unlikely that we're going to see the exponential price growth in the housing market that we saw in the past. But as prices rise, the value to return ratio decreases, and therefore investors have to start to think, well, do they raise rents as a way of getting an adequate return, whereas in the past investors have been content to get returns via capital gains. That's less likely now, and so I think there's some unexplored and perhaps unpredictable outcomes there.
All right, now to Tony. G'day, Tony. Hello, Tony.
Hello. How you going?
Not too bad, mate. What's your question?
Listen, I was just going to say, you know, the kids won't live where they need to live today. There's housing out in the northern suburbs of Melbourne. For, you can buy blocks of land for under $100,000. They won't live there.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, that's something that Nicole did address, I think, earlier, and that is if the infrastructure's not there, if the jobs aren't there, you can't expect people to go and live there. Is that that's the point?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to look at the price of petrol and the cost of commutes. There's some interesting analysis done a few years ago that just looks at, you know, where mortgages are and distance to CBD and the impacts of travel costs. And you do find that the cheaper areas are, of course, the furthest and the most car dependent. And those costs add up, particularly if you've got, you know, two members of a household both needing to drive in different directions.
Yeah. Tony and Corinne in Perth say we should have a limit on gearing per title of about $300,000. Would that make any difference, do you think, Jackie, that if there was a limit on how much the negative gearing was?
Look, possibly. I can't comment on whether that particular model would be an effective solution to the problem. And I think there's a whole range of issues here we'd need to consider and certainly a range of options for reform.
That might be a way of getting into it, though, rather than abolishing it all at once.
Well, that's right. Yeah,
to limit the amount, yes.
I think the point is that we should be gearing our subsidy towards affordable housing. Yeah. And the negative gearing at the moment does nothing in terms of trying to leverage new affordable housing. There's other models, such as the National Rental Affordability Scheme, which is limited in number, but at least it targets affordable housing.
Okay, Paul, g'day.
Hello. Rod, Jackie and Nicole. I don't have any questions, I just have some statements. Back in the 1950s when my parents came out here as migrants, they were able to buy houses at very affordable prices. Today, the same house is like overinflated, overrated and overpriced. I have homes all over the world, and I still feel that Australia is the most expensive place in the world to purchase a property. Why is this?
I'll tell you why. I think one of the reasons is that we pay living wages to people. I suppose that's a major thing, Paul, but I take the point. But, yeah, I mean, isn't that part of the problem, that we pay our people too much? Jackie? Nicole?
I mean, certainly I was at a really interesting lecture by George Gulster, who's from Detroit, and he pointed out that housing affordability is actually better in Sydney than in Detroit. Now, that's not our property prices, and obviously I'd actually rather live in Sydney, even if I have to pay more for my house.
You can buy an entire suburb in Detroit, probably for the price of Australian house.
Yes, but look at the average, the median income. Yeah. And the point is that when you have a cycle of disinvestment and low incomes, then obviously house prices are going to be lower as well. Okay. So it is something about our prosperity.
Sophie Costas is the New South Wales Shadow Minister for Housing. Good evening.
Good evening, Rod, Jackie and Nicole. I'm having a terrific listen driving down from Maitland, so I'm really enjoying your conversation.
Thank you. And what comment, you're saying that moves being made in New South Wales to look into this?
Well, just recently, the New South Wales Legislative Council, the upper house, moved to establish a select committee to inquire into social, public and affordable housing. And the closing date for submissions is the 28th of February next year. And public hearings will be held in March. So it'd be fantastic for Nicole and Jackie to put in a submission and also to your listeners to know that it's something that we're passionate. The committee will be chaired by Paul Green, who is Christian Democrats, and it's a cross-party committee. So it's probably one of the, I guess, once in a generation inquiry that will look into everything, and it's something that I'm very passionate about, particularly as the public housing waiting list has exceeded over 120,000 people on the
list. So can I ask you, though, as a shadow minister, if at some point in the next 10 or 12 years you return to government, will you make a, well, it's a pretty big majority that the government have got in New South Wales. Do you make a commitment that if this committee says that negative gearing, for example, should go, that you would, you know, go along with that?
Well, I can't make that commitment.
I want you to make that commitment, if
well,
that's all right, Sophie.
I can't make that commitment, but I know that there have been a number of reports. There's been a report by the McKill Institute. There have been a number of reports that have made this an issue, and it's something that it is, and I'm not going to say it's something that we need to work, both state and federal need to work toward, but I think it's the responsibility of the state government, whichever political party is in power, To ensure that there is enough rental accommodation and low-cost accommodation.
Okay.
We've got a massive problem at the moment, particularly in that area of crisis and affordable rental accommodation.
All right. I appreciate you taking the time
to call.
And I hope you continue to enjoy the show as you drive through regional New South Wales. So you're with Rod Quinn, this is The Nightlife. Lisa says, from the moment I started my first part-time job at 15, my parents made me save 10% towards home ownership. Many of my contemporaries have splurged $40,000 on weddings and now complain I am lucky to own my own home. I think the whole society is valuing the wrong things. Should we be taught at school, perhaps, how to save our money, Jackie?
Actually, I don't know how to answer that question. Look, possibly, but I think the underlying issue is not about the inability of young people to save, but about the lack of supply of affordable housing dwellings and price inflation. So in a bigger picture sense, so those are the major issues. Of course, it wouldn't hurt for young people to have skills in budgeting and saving, but I wouldn't say that's the major policy challenge we're facing.
Here's one, though. Joe in Perth, I think it is, says, Tasmania has two cities large enough to provide education and employment choices and competition. Western Australia has one big city. All who move to WA want a house in Perth, a carefully planned strategy to ensure house prices will accelerate in Perth. So, I mean, it's the case that there just aren't enough big cities in the country, isn't that it?
Well, and also the infrastructure is very poor in areas outside capital cities, and I think that's what Nicole's been saying. The Prime Minister has said he wants to be the infrastructure Prime Minister. I think what we'd like to see is more than ports and roads, but let's see affordable housing and let's see transport and other community infrastructure that will make these places livable and viable places to be.
But, you know, the train line to Mandurah in Western Australia, in Perth, there. That was fantastic, all of a sudden. But that opened up, and all of a sudden those house prices, I think, went through the roof there. So it was a great piece of infrastructure, but it might have had the opposite effect in fact, helping people afford houses there.
I mean, that's a really good point, Rod. One of the things that we haven't talked about in this conversation, and in fact we don't talk about it much in Australia, is actually making sure that when these major investments occur, and when we release new land for housing, is that we make sure a proportion of that new housing is affordable, and we can do that through policy requirements.
In what way, though?
Well, we can, for instance, use a target, which is what happens in South Australia, 15% in South Australia. In the ACT, it's 15 to 20%, 20% in inner areas of housing that's produced in a development simply must be affordable to people on moderate incomes, often to purchase.
All right. Nigel, good evening.
Good evening. Your guests seem to be concentrating on investors and the negative gearing as the major barriers for people buying homes. There's a lot of cost involved through government and council regulation. We live in Melbourne, and around our way, government requires that, you know, roads and all the infrastructure be put in, and that cost gets put on by the developer of the estate, and then the local council say you've got to build, say, a 25 square minimum house, and it's got to be built of this, it's got to be built of that, it's got to include solar, it's got to include water tanks, it's got to include... And all of this adds greatly to the cost of homes. So there are a lot of other factors other than...
Yeah, that's a very, very good point, and I'll get Jackie and Nicole to comment on that. Government regulation, Jackie.
Well, I guess that question there is sort of one about infrastructure as well, and I suppose my question is, why are we leaving it to the buyers themselves to pay for the costs of community infrastructure in a new area? And I guess my question is whether governments shouldn't be, meeting some of the cost of that. Okay. But Nicole would have more of a view on that. It's her area.
I mean, you can see infrastructure's capitalised in the value that we attribute to established suburbs. So certainly if governments wanted to even that up, there would be more reinvestment in existing outer areas and in selected new release areas, provided that we're then able to make sure that we're still getting affordable homes produced in those locations. As to the cost of other regulations in terms of building controls, sustainability stuff, etc., research for the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute has investigated that. It's impossible to have a definitive answer, but certainly when we talk to developers, it's interesting that they will certainly say they will charge what the market will bear, and so they often use sustainability features as a selling point when they're marketing their homes. And in other words, it's very difficult to see whether that's actually driving up the cost of a new dwelling. One thing that you don't want to do is have a lot of cheap housing that doesn't hold its long-term value.
Okay, Joe wants to talk about subdivisions. G'day, Joe.
Hi, g'day. Before I do that, though, if you want to talk about negative gearing and getting rid of it, you should talk to Paul Keating. He got his fingers burnt with that. Getting back to subdivision, in the 1950s, somebody brought that up before. If a poultry farmer had 5 acres, all he had to do was to get a surveyor in and put in a gravel road and subdivide the blocks of land. Then what would happen is that the federal government would give grants to the councils and so on, and they'd put in sewerage and so on. Now, then somebody said, oh, no, we'll make the subdivider pay, which is, of course, nonsense, because all he does is pass it on with a premium. Now, this is what has happened. And I don't know what the governments are doing with the money they used to use to subsidise the roads and so on. But the other thing is the time it takes. A subdivider buys a large area of land. It probably takes about 4 years before the blocks of land are sold. They pay in that time. They pay land tax, they pay rates, they pay all sorts of things, and then it takes forever for councils to approve the design and so on and so on.
Okay, all right, I'll get Nicole and Jackie to comment on that. Subdivisions.
I mean, there's a number of complex issues there. One issue, of course, is that you can't simply continue to extend on the edge of cities. There becomes a point at which demand drops off, and I think one of the callers mentioned blocks, you know, available at a relatively low price in Melbourne and people not taking them up, which also incidentally affects greenfield housing developers. In terms of should governments come in and put infrastructure in for subdivisions, well, yes, if they're in the right location. But the problem that you get is a lot of speculative development, often not connected to existing centres or to places where there has been investment. And I think there have been mistakes in the past where there's been an attempt to sort of retrofit those areas, but ultimately they're hard to reconnect into the transport infrastructure.
Meg says 40% of the cost of a new home and land is government levies. Do you reckon that's right?
Well, once again, for the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute, we did try to track that figure down. I personally spent about 2 years talking to developers and trying to absolutely get to the bottom of that figure, because it is bandied around.
Is it true, though?
Developers tell us that they sell, well, not a developer lobby group, but an individual, you know, developer selling a block of land sells it at the price that a purchaser is willing to pay. Now, whether that included a 40% indeterminable figure or not, I don't know. They sell it for the price that the market will bear. And you might ask why they don't release a whole lot of lots at once as well, if it's so slow to get approval.
Okay. Yeah, Mark wants to remind us what it was like in the old days. G'day, Mark.
G'day. How are you?
All right. You were renting in the Keating years?
Yeah, I was renting in the Keating years. I actually had to move house when negative gearing was removed. It was an absolute nightmare. I ended up having to move in with friends. There was absolutely nothing to rent. I was one property that we were looking to rent, we put in an application. We were one of 80 people who applied for the one place.
Right.
So if saying that negative gearing doesn't actually create rental properties is rubbish. Something else I'd like to add is that I actually have an investment property in the city, and that was a new block, right? So one of the earlier comments was that needed gearing doesn't actually provide new buildings. This did. I bought this off the plan, right? It was something new.
All right, Mark, I'll get to Jackie to comment on that. Jackie.
Yes, it's not to say that negative gearing can't be used to buy new products, but that 92% of negatively geared investments are in our existing housing stock. So the vast majority of that is not going into new housing. We have touched on the Paul Keating experiment, shall we say, a number of times this evening. And I think, as I said earlier, there are a couple of things going on there. One, it was done at a time that the housing boom was coming to an end in anyway. And there was a story going on around higher interest rates and a shift of investor preferences, all of which I think contributed to killing off that boom. So there is a debate about, you know, what the role of the negative gearing change was in that context, vis-a-vis those other factors. We certainly think it's not a reason to take this debate off the table. And there's certainly, right, the conversation is ripe to be had about this.
Okay, Nolene is our last caller, and I'm sorry for those we couldn't get to. Hello, Nolene.
Oh, good evening. I just came in a little while ago from visiting a friend who's not well. Anyway, in your station, I picked up your subject. I did want to discuss...
We don't have a lot of time, Nolene, so if you could just quickly get to the
what
point.
What impact has the sale of a lot of the stock of the housing department had on the rise in prices and the lack of availability?
Yeah, very good question. Nicole?
In terms of the sale of public housing?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Look, relative to need, the proportion of public housing has declined. There's now only about 4% of households in Australia who are living in affordable housing. We've never had an enormous amount historically. But what has changed is the profile of households now assisted public housing has changed. And we're now seeing only people with very high needs getting newly assisted in public housing, and so that's been an issue. So what tended to happen was when public housing was sold, which followed international trends, it didn't tend to be replaced at the same volume.
And not in the same areas either. I think the other issue has been the moving out of those people who've been in public housing into outer areas. Mm. And we've discussed tonight the issues with infrastructure, transport, access to jobs, and that social stratification that happens as a result.
This sort of problem takes decades to reach the peak we're at now. We can't solve the problem overnight, but if there's one thing that a government could do to get us on the road to more affordable housing, what would it be?
It's very hard to pick one. I think negative gearing has been a constant theme, so I would say it's time to review negative gearing and other housing
settings. Would
have
a huge effect on rental properties, that maybe all of a sudden people are buying houses instead of buying houses to rent to others?
Well, there's ways to redesign it, as I said, to target that investment into new and affordable stock, and that would be a much more efficient and fair and beneficial policy setting, I would argue. But there's a range of other things I would do. I could go on all night.
Nicole?
I'd be saying that a substantial proportion of new housing development, and particularly new inner city housing development, needs to be affordable, either affordable for sale or affordable rental.
But so the government determines what the price would be and then would prevent people reselling the property?
Once the properties, it depends on the level of subsidy, is the short answer to that. So in South Australia, for instance, you're actually able to deliver affordable houses without subsidy in certain outer areas. Okay. Therefore, you don't need to limit resale. Where there is subsidy, then you do need to look at recapturing that.
Nicole Gurran is from the Faculty of Architecture, Design and Planning at the University of Sydney. Nicole, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks, Rod.
And Jackie Phillips, Australians for Affordable Housing. Thank you very much as well.
Thanks for having me.